From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour is made in a question. And it's a question that almost certainly someone has asked you at some point in your life. Are you happy? As in, are you truly happy? Not just today or right now. Do you consider yourself a happy person? SUNY Geneseo professor Jim Allen took a wide look at the research that has been done for decades on happiness and well-being, and he's compiled his findings in a new book. It's called The Psychology of Happiness in the Modern World. It's a look at our happiness that is impacted by everything from materialism to income inequality to personality. We're going to be talking about pizza analogies, satiation hypothesis, why $75,000 as an income level matters in some forms of research. We'll see if Jim agrees. And a lot more here, self-determination theory. But I am going to ask our listeners to think about that question. Are you happy, and what do you think impacts your happiness the most? Jim Allen is here in studio. Thanks for reaching out and sharing the book with us. We appreciate it.
Thank you very much. I'm happy to be here.
You're happy to be here, just for the moment. It's great to have you. In a moment, we're going to get right to that conversation, but I briefly want to welcome our colleague Karen Chakurji here, because this is a big, big day for WXXI News, for the Inclusion Desk, for the work that Karen Chakurji and Veronica Volk and Denise Young and so many people have been putting in on a brand new podcast that is now out. Hi, Karen. How are you?
Hey, Evan. I'm doing well. How are you?
Are you happy?
I'm doing okay. Hanging in.
Senator Chakurji, you didn't answer the question. No, I asked because I know anybody at WXXI knows how many hours have gone into, it goes into any podcast, but to make it so well put together, and that's what this podcast is. If you don't know about Exited, Karen's here briefly just to tell you what you can find right now. What is Exited?
Exited is a podcast that we've been developing for months now, and the first episode is released today. It's a 5-part series that you can check out at exitedpodcast.org. And so the premise of the whole podcast is this moment that for young people with disabilities, when they either turn 21 or get a diploma, they're no longer in the school system. And it's a real turning point, because at that moment, they need to basically, A, figure out what they're going to do next, what's an appropriate fit for them, and B, they have to get to know a whole lot of new systems. So it's a very overwhelming time where you're getting a lot of stuff about, you know, how the education system has prepared them and kind of where they're going to go next.
There are really profound moments of journalism in just the first episode that I've had a chance to listen to. And listeners, again, it's exitedpodcast.org.
That's right.
There are moments that you have people in, you know, important positions in New York State kind of telling you very bluntly that at times the system either doesn't look fair or looks sort of disorganized or is sort of a mess. Mm-hmm. And what do you hope, you know, eventually comes out of this for listeners? Either start with this one episode, but I hope everyone stays on for all 5. What do you hope comes out of this, Karen?
You know, these policies are complicated, and they can be a little bit dry to people who don't necessarily have to interact with them. And so I think what we tried to do in this podcast was to say, like, look, there are all these policies that exist, and they really matter. They really, you know, impact people on a very in a very real way. So I hope that people will take that away from this. You know, they'll understand that these things really are meaningful.
I think we have a lot of listeners who care, have a sort of an egalitarian mindset. They care about equal opportunity. They also like really compelling podcasts, let's be honest. And so every listener who's listening right now, if you've got a podcast subscription feed on your smart device or a smartphone or whatever it is, add Exited, because it's not just a podcast for people in what you might call a disability community. It is for all of us to hear and understand. And there are really also beautifully funny moments and really touching moments. And can you just briefly tell us who we're going to meet when it comes to 17-year-old Nate?
Yeah. So we meet most kind of first and foremost, we meet Nate Taylor, who's a 17-year-old high school student in Pittsburgh. And we learn about his kind of likes and the things that he really excels at, which is a lot of art-related stuff, and his deep love of anything related to the Titanic.
I love that.
And then we also meet a lot of people in his life. We meet his parents and teachers and various people in different school districts locally. But we also go to, you know, a member of the Board of Regents. And we also hear sound from a public forum held on Long Island and different parents and lawmakers who are talking. So it's really a whole bunch of people coming from different perspectives to talk about this one issue.
There are touching stories, but there are also some tough questions.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll just ask you a yes or no so you don't have to elaborate
okay.
any further. Did everybody that you want to talk in the system, every school district, did everybody call you back and say, yes, we'll be there to participate?
No.
Okay, that's what happens in journalism. But but at the same time, you and the team have done this remarkable work. Before I let you go, mm-hmm. just briefly again for our listeners, the
sure.
term exited, that's the name of the podcast. It refers to what?
Exited is a word that people use to talk about people leaving the school system. People exit the school system, just like you enter and then you exit. But it's a word that is largely used to describe people who are not necessarily graduating in the technical sense of receiving a diploma. So they've exited the school system. They're leaving, but they're not necessarily graduating.
I'm so proud to be a colleague of Karen Chakurji
oh, gosh.
And
okay.
the team. There. I know. But I know how much work has gone into it. It is so good.
Thank you.
And this is going to get a lot of buzz here, and I hope across the country. But it's exitedpodcast.org.
Mm-hmm.
Karen Chakurji, the voice behind it. Outstanding work. We're going to be listening, obviously, today. The first episode's out, but the mm-hmm. four more episodes to come when?
Next week, Monday. Next episode.
All right.
Episode 2.
So the next four Mondays.
That's the plan.
Oh my gosh, did I just hold you to something you're not ready to be held to?
We'll see. That's the plan.
Exitedpodcast.org. Thank you, Karen.
Thank you, Evan.
That's Karen Chakurji. Check that out right now. We're talking happiness this hour, and Jim Allen, who's an associate professor of psychology at SUNY Geneseo, is my guest. And Jim, there's a lot of research. I mean, you take us back, and we're going to, in a moment, go back to 1974. I hope this will be an interesting and fun hour for our listeners, but also important and educational, because I think there's something, some parts of your book that I thought, well, that's sort of intuitive, or I would have guessed that, but then there are parts that were not, or parts of research that start to conflict with one another, and part of your work was kind of sorting through that and making a determination. But why happiness now? Why did you want to put this book together now?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. It's part of the culture, I think, right now. Lots of other people are interested in it. And I stumbled upon research about materialism and happiness, doing other work, and it just really caught my attention. And this is about 10 years ago, and started thinking about teaching a course in the area. And through the experience of teaching the course, just of course, learn more and more about the area, and thought it was time to write a different book that focused more on socio-structural and cultural kinds of factors that affected happiness rather than just individualistic kind of factors.
Well, you mentioned materialism. I wasn't going to start there, but I did want to tell you that I have a garage that has 12 cars in it.
Oh, boy.
But I really feel like I need 13. Is that next car going to make me happy?
Well, probably not. Probably not, unless there's some kind of basic psychological need that's being met by having an additional car.
Well, I have, in that moment of purchase, will I have a surge of dopamine or something, and then will it level off?
Yes, that's probably what's going to happen. There's going to be definitely a diminishing return. You may feel some immediate kind of rush, but it's not likely to last much longer.
And I can joke about a big garage filled with cars. But honestly, as a parent, I think many people, me included, have experienced that moment where you think, you know, my child has enough in the way of material
right.
things. But right now at the store, they want this thing.
Right.
I can make them happy at this moment.
Right.
But if I get this toy that they think they want and need 5 days from now, they're not playing with it. They thought they needed it. And have I contributed to their actual well-being?
Yeah, the research seems to indicate not. And unfortunately, as a parent myself, I've fallen in the same trap.
Me too.
But unfortunately, even contributed to long-term lack of well-being. And it's a tough situation. The culture is oriented so much towards buying things. One of the things I tell my class about is that an ad for women's shoes that says, your boyfriend has a boyfriend, and then fill the void and buy this new style of shoes. And the idea here is that materialistic goods can fill emotional voids or emotional wounds in our our lives. And it's something the culture is constantly teaching us. Unfortunately, it doesn't. And if anything, it has the reverse effect.
We're going to come back to materialism a little bit later, because as Jim just said there, you may think, well, materialism doesn't really help much. It actually can hurt. And the research is interesting on this. We're going to come back to that as we work through it, but I'm going to kind of peel it back to money and income and some basics that are an important standard here for understanding well-being and happiness. Before I do that, I will tell our listeners, if you want to call the program this hour, I'd love to hear from you about, you know, how you view happiness, questions on perhaps income, maybe your own experiences in life. 844-295-TALK. It's toll free. 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester. 263-9994. It's connections at WXXI.org. If you want to email the program, you can find me on Twitter at Evan Dawson or at MMacMedia for producer Megan Mack on Twitter there. And I think as you listen to some of the research that Jim has collected and pulled together and kind of analyzed for us, maybe you'll find yourself saying, yes, that tracks with my life, or no, it doesn't. Hmm. We're going to talk about raises that people might get at work or income levels, et cetera. So there's a lot to discuss as it pertains to happiness. I want to go back to 1974. What's the Easterlin paradox?
Yes, that's a very important idea. Researcher named Richard Easterlin discovered in reviewing the literature that there were small differences in happiness depending on income within a culture, within a society. So the wealthier are somewhat happier than the less wealthy within a country. But there weren't differences between countries. Less wealthy countries generally weren't less happy than non-wealthy countries. The exception for that is the very, very poor countries. There was a basic level of income that, of course, everybody needs to have some level of happiness. But once that was reached, wealthier countries generally weren't happier than non-wealthy countries. And then the third piece, and in my mind the most provocative piece, is that economic growth doesn't seem to increase happiness, which is a real shocker in a country such as ours that bases so much social policy on the premise that economic growth is gonna make us all happier, going to make us all better.
The book is called The Psychology of Happiness in the Modern World, and there is a section where you point to China, lots of economic growth, but not necessarily a corresponding leap in well-being. But can we just make sure we understand terms, well-being, happiness? I mean, what's the relation?
Sure. In the book, I'm using those terms largely interchangeably.
Okay.
Well-being, happiness, life satisfaction, and so forth. There are some technical differences between those, but not really necessary, I don't think, to go into now.
But China's a place you can point to that says, of course, they've had economic growth, but not necessarily that corresponding leap in other factors.
Right, they've had astounding economic growth, and if anything, well-being has gone down as on a societal level as they've experienced that dramatic increase in economic growth. There seem to be a couple factors that are related here. One is the loss of social capital. Economic growth, particularly the kind that China's experienced, has broken down traditional ways that people relate to each other and general cultural traditions, and left people kind of adrift. Another thing that's happened is income inequality has skyrocketed, and there's a lot of research that indicates that income inequality reduces happiness as well. And it's not just China. There's research about a bunch of emerging or transitioning economies and experiencing economic growth, and while the economic growth has made the country as a whole wealthier, it hasn't made the society as a whole happier.
Income inequality would seem to be a big factor there.
And
I'm going to get back to there in a second, because Jim's book gives us a really good sort of walkthrough and the different ways of looking at income, money, societal growth, economic growth. I mean, they're all related, but they sort of pertain slightly differently at times. So we will come back to income inequality. But before then, I mentioned, so this Easterlin paradox, 1974, he comes out with this paradox, this three observations, essentially, in 1974. And then some of his colleagues over the years started to try to poke holes in it.
Right.
So where did his colleagues start to try to poke holes in these ideas, Jim?
Well, the question about whether economic growth increases happiness and wealth within a country, the size of that relationship, whether it's related to happiness, has been studied very, very thoroughly. The upshot of that is that Eshelman was at least technically wrong, that economic growth probably does in the long term increase happiness, but the effect is very, very small, and it's qualified by a certain kind of economic growth that doesn't increase income inequality and doesn't tear the social fabric apart. Qualification is a really, really strong qualification. So in essence, Eshelman was correct. There seems to be a point where society reaches a certain level of income, and even though further economic growth does increase well-being, happiness slightly, the effect is so small that it's barely recognizable. The one way to think about this is a doubling of wealth leads to the same amount of increase in happiness. So, for instance, if a country goes from an annual or an average income of $10,000 to $20,000, they'll reach a certain increment in increase in happiness. To get that same increment in increase in happiness, a country that has an average income of, say, $75,000 would have to double their income to go to $150,000 per person to get the same increment of happiness. I'm not sure I'm explaining this really clearly.
I think you are, and tell me if I'm on the right track here, because I thought there's something really important about this. I went into this thinking, surely people who are struggling the most, people living in poverty,
right,
are less likely to report being happy or having a strong level of well-being, and that some increase in income is almost certainly going to correspond for them strongly with
correct.
Okay. Yeah. And so the research supports this.
Right.
Okay.
Right,
so at the very at the extreme bottom levels, that's why I looked at Eshelman and I thought, come on, that can't be right.
Right.
I think if you exclude what we would think is the most impoverished places or nations, then it starts to make more sense, because the more money you have,
right.
And this isn't like some sort of socialist utopian dream here. This is what research shows. The more more money you have, the less, you know, impact it's going to be if you make a little more. So if you're making $10,000, of course, if you make $20,000, you've just doubled your income.
Right,
that's remarkable.
Right.
But if you're making $75,000 and now you're making $85,000, not that much of a almost immeasurable or imperceptible, right?
Correct.
Okay. So, and then there is another piece of research that I think, I don't know if you chose $75,000 on purpose, but when it comes to that income level, in 2009 dollars, there was at least one study that showed $75,000 is kind of the cutoff, that you can make more and make more and make more. But once you start, once you get to $75,000 back in 2009 dollars, which today would maybe, I don't know, 80, 85.
Right.
There isn't a whole lot of return for you to keep making more money.
No, there's not. And if your goal is to increase your own personal happiness, there seem to be other strategies that would be more effective rather than try to increase your income. Increase the quality of your relationships, for example. Have close, emotionally intimate relationships. Try to develop more free time and so forth would probably give you a better payoff, so to speak, in happiness than trying to increase your income.
Okay, and you feel, in your read of the research, that's pretty solid.
Right, uh-huh.
Okay, again, listeners, I'd love to ask you directly on this, to the extent that you want to share, or your thoughts on it. You know, you think about the first raise you got, and Jim points out in his book, most people are not in positions to ever end up with a $10,000 raise at one time, or those kind of things.
I mean,
but they do happen. Think about whatever the first raise you got, or the first income levels. You know, did you think, or maybe a job that you got, not, you know, in your earlier years, but maybe the second job you got that you thought, well, this is going to be sort of a forever situation. Did it change your happiness level? And was it because of the money? Was it because of the income? Was it because of the satisfaction of what you were doing? I think the research probably is borne out very, very well here. And it's really interesting what Jim is saying about how much money we make. But I'd love to hear from you. 844-295-TALK. It's toll free. 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. By the way, thanks to our wonderful connection staff, Megan Mack tells us $2009, $75,000. Today is $87,672. So that's it. If you make $88,000, you do not need to make more money if you want to be happy. You can look for other ways to be happy. That's not universally true. Jim, there's going to be some listeners who say, you're overgeneralizing.
Right.
What do you say
right.
to them?
Yeah, there are personality differences that make some that do matter. And psychologists, when they talk about these kind of things, are talking about the average person in society. So, you know, they're not the average person. The other thing that is worth saying about this is that what's really important is meeting basic psychological needs, our needs to feel like we're our own person, our needs to feel like we're related to others, and our needs to feel like we're competent. If somebody is making more money and in the process satisfying those needs, the chances are that they are going to be happier as they make more money. The people that aren't going to be happier as they make more money are people that are pursuing money for its own sake or so they can use it to impress other people. So there are times when you love the restaurant you're operating or you love the small business that you're operating, and as it becomes more successful, you're satisfying these basic psychological needs at the same time you're making more money. That's a difference as well.
So it strikes me a couple of things, and I'm going to ask Jim to offer an opinion in a moment here. But let me also ask you, generally speaking now,
right.
knowing everyone is different, let's say somebody's making $88,000, and they're like, well, that's the cutoff. Research indicates to me I'm not going to be much happier if I keep making more money. But I also find the most satisfaction when I'm giving to others. So if
right.
I could double my salary,
right, right,
and then I'm going to take almost everything that I've gotten, and that gives me the power to be even more charitable and to impact lives, that might strike me as a very legitimate way to start increasing your happiness quotient.
Yeah, that's conceivably possible. It depends on how much you have to pay psychologically to double your salary. How much time is that going to take away from your family? How much time is that going to take away from, again, meeting these basic psychological needs? And for most of us, to double our salary, the amount of effort we'd have to put into work would be psychologically diminishing, or in terms of happiness. But yeah, potentially, theoretically, that could work. And in fact, I do have some ways in the book about how we can spend money to make ourselves happy, and we could talk about that if you'd like.
Oh, that's how I wanted to. You're looking ahead in the script. That's how I wanted to close the hour here. But I do want to ask you, given the fact that we know that income inequality, China is a good example, but certainly in our country, we've got issues with income inequality.
Right,
income inequality seems to have a pretty strong impact on how people within a given geographic area might view their own happiness based on their own income. So that's one thing. And then when you look at these sort of diminishing returns beyond certain income thresholds, isn't it within the national interest of just about anywhere, this country included, to try to make sure as few people are living in poverty as possible because of not just their own well-being, but for everybody?
Sure, sure. That's somewhat a value judgment, and I suspect that there might be fellow citizens out there that would disagree with your statement, in my opinion, unfortunately, but I certainly agree. I mean, it's certainly in the national interest, in my opinion, that we that people have a basic sense of a state of living. And in fact, the happiest countries in the world, which happen to be Northern European countries, that's one of their characteristics, is that there's a basic sense of decent living for all citizens in that country. And, you know, you mentioned income inequality. Solving the income inequality problem would perhaps help bring up the people at the bottom, and it would also help everybody, including people that are wealthier, be happier. There's research out of the United Kingdom that shows that solving income inequality problems lifts the happiness not just of people that aren't wealthy, but also of people who are wealthy.
It's not necessarily zero sum, because
right.
If people at the bottom of the income scale are lifted out of poverty, or lift themselves out of poverty, and have a corresponding jump in their self-satisfaction or well-being or happiness.
Right.
It doesn't mean that somebody who is, let's say income is zero sum. Maybe you were making 150 before. Now you're making 100. Well, it's zero sum in income, but it wouldn't be zero sum in terms of happiness. At least the
right.
research indicates you should not expect to be less happy as a person.
Yeah, and in fact, you should expect to be happier. There, one way to think about this is social indicator research. There are fewer suicides society wide. There's less problem with obesity. The crime rate goes down. A lot of things that affect everybody's well-being and happiness are less of a problem in societies with lower levels of income. Inequality.
And you mentioned the happiest countries. Denmark at the top?
Yeah, Denmark is typically at the top. Switzerland, the northern European countries tend to be up there.
So your readers will eventually ask, and you touched on it briefly, though, but what is their secret?
Yeah, there are a host of characteristics that are associated with happiness in those countries, and one is this standard level of decent living for everybody in the country. Other characteristics include a functioning democracy, a clean environment, a lack of corruption in the society, and so forth. But certainly this feeling of a basic standard level of decent living for everybody is important. Another word that we can explore if you want is decommodification. And I don't know if you're interested in going there, but where people are treated like commodities, so my worth depends on the market. My well-being or my standard of living depends completely on the market, the way a bushel of wheat's worth depends on market forces. In those kinds of societies, happiness tends to be much lower. In the northern European countries, individuals don't tend to be commodified. They're not treated as if they're commodities.
Listeners, I would refer you to a recent conversation we had about neoliberalism, which is all about, at least in it's complex. I don't want to say it's all about, but in some ways it's about commodification of just about everything.
Sure. Exactly.
Healthcare.
Yeah. Right.
Who votes, who has value, who has status. And what I think what Professor Allen is telling us is in countries that hew towards those neoliberal models, there's not they're not at the top of the happiest countries of the world.
No, they're not. And the United States is surprisingly low in terms of happiness. We range somewhere between 15 and 20 most years, especially when you take into account our level of income. Countries that are much less wealthy than we are tend to be at the top. Evan, you mentioned Denmark, and just one example. Denmark, the average square footage of housing is about 1,500 square feet. Where in the United States, the average house is about 2,400 square feet. So objectively, in terms of income, their level of wealth is much lower than ours, but yet they're much happier.
This is such a great moment for our listeners who just had this whiplash and went 2,400 square feet. I don't live in a 2,300 square foot house. My friends don't live in a 23. I don't know anybody in a house that big. That's sort of exactly the point here.
Right.
It's not. It's sort of median and mean here. It's not that everybody's got 2,300 square foot houses. It's that there's enough 10,000 square foot houses that it changes the average.
Yeah. Right.
And and it's the average size home is smaller in countries that are happier. But you didn't answer whether Denmark has Fox News and CNN and MSNBC. I mean, surely that is hurting us.
Yeah, that's a good question. Certainly political discord would affect this. Although one of the things that people come back to who question this idea of the Scandinavian countries being happier is that they say that their countries are much more homogeneous politically and culturally than the United States, and that it's not their social welfare policies that are driving their happiness. Instead, it's the nature of their societies just demographically. That question's been examined really, really closely, and it turns out that the homogeneity of the society, both culturally and politically, doesn't account for the differences in happiness between, again, those Scandinavian countries and for instance, the United States.
How do they know that?
Yeah, that's I have to go into some statistical voodoo and mumbo-jumbo to explain that, but there are ways
But it's been asked and answered.
Yeah, there are ways to isolate statistically potential alternative explanations and statistically control for them. And it's not the same thing as doing a randomized experiment, but the evidence is pretty strong.
My guest is Jim Allen, who is an associate professor of psychology at SUNY Geneseo, and his new book is called The Psychology of Happiness in the Modern World. Essentially, it's a textbook, but I enjoyed the read because it's easy to follow the research. It's interesting when Jim brings you to research in one place that might conflict with ideas in another. He does a really good job of presenting them in a clear way.
Thank you very much.
And helps you understand, yeah, you know, why he's drawing certain conclusions. So let's get our only break of the hour. We'll come back. We're going to get back to materialism and what we can learn. And Jim has some ideas on, yeah, happiness for all of us.
All right.
A short break and much more to come.
All right.
Coming up in our second hour, after Shiny Happy People, REM could have done anything they wanted to. 25 years ago this month, they released Automatic for the People. They went dark. A band at the height of their powers made a choice that went against what all of the people in management said would have been easy. We'll talk about making hard choices in entertainment and art next hour. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. We asked our listeners on Twitter what are the biggest factors in your happiness? And lining right up with some of what Jim Allen has pulled together, the research that's been going on for decades about happiness, for his new book, The Psychology of Happiness in the Modern World, he points out that, you know, if you think just making more money is going to do that for you, just keep in mind it's not likely to be the case. Or it might make you a little bit more happy, but there's other factors that will be bigger for you. So I asked our listeners, what would you say is the single biggest factor that influences your happiness? And we're hearing from a lot of people. And Davis says health. Health is a big
one,
obviously.
Yeah, that is important.
Vanessa, how much time I get to spend on things that I like to do, which
sure.
could mean hobbies, fulfilling work, and also self-care.
Sure.
Sam writes, connection to other people.
Sure.
April says, progress made on any front, although the smell of a good Sunday sauce can help in any. Sunday sauce can help in any situation. Jim says, the balance of time and commitments. Elizabeth says, a sense of security.
Mm-hmm.
Chris
mm-hmm.
says, sleep? Oh, crap. I'm with you there. Yeah. I'm with you there. Jenny says, having things to laugh about and people in my life to laugh
good,
with.
Good. Very good.
And Nahoko says, a sense of trust in oneself and others. Nobody there said one more car in the garage.
Right. And, you know, one of the things that's interesting about that to me is that people are mentioning individualistic kinds of factors that we have immediate control over. And those are all really, really important things, particularly relationships. I think we fail to recognize that decisions that are made by policymakers that we have little direct control over affect our happiness as well. The unemployment rate, things that affect income inequality and so forth. Well, so while I certainly recognize that all those individualized factors that the listeners mentioned are vitally important, one of the things I want to do in the book is to draw people's attention to these things that we don't have direct control over and perhaps we should have more control over.
Here's an interesting comment. Nahoko follows up to say, I think the United States is super obsessed with the idea of happiness, and people think they should be happy all the time. And I wonder if that contributes to overall unhappiness, since our expectations seem unnaturally high.
Yeah, it could. And one of the pieces of advice that comes out of the literature is not have overly high expectations for happiness, unreasonable expectations. Another piece of advice is that the way we pursue happiness as individuals is really important as well. Happiness probably isn't something that we can pursue directly. We can decide that we want to go out and try to be happier, but then once we start pursuing it, we have to do it for intrinsic reasons. I'm cultivating relationships with other people because I like these people and I value that relationship, not because I'm using them to make myself happier, for example.
James writes to us from the Mez, the House of Jimez. Oh, James, we used to love playing music in your place when it was there. He says, I used to own a cafe And he says, I made a carrot cake that was quite popular. I quit using Kraft cream cheese when I noticed that the packaging said consumers prefer Kraft Philly style cream cheese. I never thought of my customers as consumers. They were people.
Oh, great.
Many of whom were my friends.
Wonderful. Wonderful.
Isn't that a nice idea?
That's a great idea.
And he sent that under the headline of commodifying of people.
Sure.
Now some listeners might say, well, that's overanalyzing it, but you seem to think that there's something there, Jim.
Yeah. The more we can think of each other as people, as individuals, and less as objects, commodities, and less as here's something or somebody we can use to get someplace, the happier we're all going to be.
Yeah. I want to mention to our listeners as well, before I grab one of your phone calls, that we're focusing this hour with psychology professor Jim Allen of SUNY Geneseo on economic systems, on income inequality, on money, materialism. That is an important part of his book on happiness. It's not everything.
Right.
We just don't happen to have all day to get
sure.
to the other
yeah,
stuff.
Right.
So that's where our mind is today. I also think it's timely. I mean, right now we have higher levels of economic inequality than we've had in many years in this
sure.
country.
Yeah.
We're seeing that in many places around the world, and that becomes a question on economic systems, values, choices, and more. So
sure.
We'll take some of your phone calls coming up, but let me close the loop on materialism, because we opened there, and this is important to point out here. It's not just some of the research, at least, indicates that materialism isn't going to, in other words, buying another car or buying a car that conveys certain status or certain things that you think will make you appeal to higher parts of society or community. It's not just that it won't make you more happy. It might make you less happy.
Correct.
And some of the research points to something called self-determination theory. Can you take us through that?
Yeah. Self-determination theory is a really important idea that was developed by researchers, theoreticians here at the University of Rochester. The basic idea is that there are basic psychological needs that we need to be met, that need to be met in order for people to be happy and in order for them to function at a high level. A quick way to describe this are needs for autonomy, which means that we need to be our own person. We need to feel like we're directing our own life. A need for competence, to feel like we're competent in the world. And then also a need for relatedness, to feel like we're connected to other people in a meaningful way. What materialism does is it tends to direct us toward external kinds of stimuli rather than meeting these basic psychological needs. So what happens is that we buy things in order to impress other people, or because we've got some kind of psychological wound, we're not feeling like we've got high self-esteem and so forth. And when we're doing that, we're not meeting these needs for competency, autonomy, and relatedness.
When it comes to self-determination, it's as simple as thinking about think about kids who love to play with toys. If they have to play only the games that are packaged by the corporations that want your kids to buy another Paw Patrol toy, and
sure.
As opposed to sort of some freelance play where
right.
they get to make it up,
right.
they
right.
may think they're happier playing with the toy from that company that convinced you to buy it, but that limits their play options.
Sure, sure it does. And it limits their ability to, again, to feel competent and so forth because autonomous, because the company is telling them how to play. Limiting their play options is a good way to describe it.
Yeah. All right, I want to grab a phone call. This is Chris in Livonia on the line. Go ahead, Chris.
Hi. I just have a couple comments. I have, over the past 3 years, gone through two kinds of cancers, and I finished my last treatment.
I'm very sorry to hear that.
Yeah, Chris, I lost you for a second. Are you still there? Phone seems to have dropped there. Chris, do me a favor here. What I'm going to do is, Chris, I'm going to cut the call. I want you to call back, and we'll grab you again. It's 844-295-TALK, toll-free, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI, if you want to call on that line. It's 263-9994. So give us a call back. And listeners, we've got 10 minutes or so. We're talking happiness with Jim Allen, whose new book is called The Psychology of Happiness in the Modern World. And so we'll get back to your phone calls coming up here. But I wanted to close the hour with some of Jim's thoughts on what we can do, and
yeah.
what we can maybe do you know, better based on the research in terms of whether how we're spending money or thoughts on those kinds of things.
Sure, sure. You know, there are things that we could do potentially as a society to make all of us happy or happier. And one of the things is to confront income inequality. Another thing is to think about the commodification of our daily lives, where people's worth is based on their market value. Another thing we can do is like Evan was pointing out, is think about the materialistic values and the materialistic culture that we live in. We allow advertisers, for example, pretty much unfettered access to our children. And these advertisers tell our children that they'll be happier, and they tell us that we'll be happier if we buy the right kind of thing. Another kind of global thing that we need to think about is economic growth. We put so much effort into producing economic growth that researchers, theoreticians have wondered whether that is really a good way to really maximize our happiness. Economic growth is not related. Economic growth is in the United States has been tremendous since about the 1950s, but happiness has not increased during that time in the United States at all. One of the things I tell my students is they often come up with potential objections, like if we slow down economic growth, the next cure for cancer will be delayed, or what will happen is we won't have the next version of the iPhone as soon, and so forth. And won't that disrupt our happiness? In reply, I tell them about the literature, the research, but I also talk about a story. When I was in college, the fanciest phone that you could get was one that had a long cord attached to it. It was attached to the wall, but it had a long cord so that we could go from the living room into the kitchen and still talk on the phone. And we were just as happy then as people are now, probably. The thing is that we didn't know about the iPhone, and because we don't know about the next iteration of the iPhone, we're not going to miss it if it takes another year or two to get it out. So economic growth, you know, another reason why it's not essential for our happiness. So these global kinds of things, I think, are definitely things that we could choose to do if we as a society are really sincerely interested in increasing happiness.
Hmm. Let me get Chris, who's back on the line with us from Livonia. Go ahead, Chris.
Okay, hopefully it goes through this time.
Sure.
Anyways, within the past 3 years, I had two cancer diagnoses, and I finished my last treatment at the end of June. And it took probably until August until I started feeling more like myself. Not 100%, but what I couldn't understand is I could not feel joy. And I didn't understand it at all. Why would I not feel joy? My markers were great, all of this. And I had to really, really reevaluate what I considered is joy. And in doing so, I had to really look deeply inside myself to find out what was important in life, at least for me. And also, I'm older. I'm an empty nester. I used to be a collector of vintage kitchen items, et cetera, and stuff like that. And I started to look around and say, do you need this? Do you use this? If you don't, then why do you have it?
Yeah, that's a great observation.
You don't want to dust anymore. You don't want all of this. So I found that by minimizing the material things in my life, I was actually uncluttering my life. And in the process, I was uncluttering my mind. Mm-hmm. And so for me, it was like I was making conscious thoughts. And in each step, and I'm still on that journey, I was getting closer to what truly made me happy. And it's not what I found is it's not what you can buy in a store. It's not another trinket for around my house that I don't need. What it is to experience it inside, fulfillment inside, the ability to share that joy that you feel with other people, whether it's a smile to a stranger
right,
in a store that you don't know.
Right.
I've also found that by not having so much money anymore because of the situation I find myself in now, it's created for me more of an environment to be creative.
Oh, good.
To make up for, okay, well, I'm not going to the store to buy this, but you know what? I can make this.
Oh, good.
Which brings me great joy.
Good, good, yeah.
Well,
so, you know, I just find, too, that some people that I know that do make very good incomes, they're very wasteful people. I see the wastefulness of their ways. I see the way they will feed, say, their pets, the table scraps, or cook extra for their pets and cut it up and give it to them. And I am very conscious of what is going on in this world today, that there are people that not only do not have roofs over their heads, four walls, they have no country to call their own. And I have a whole, in other words, a whole new different outlook on life.
Well, Chris, thank you. I've got to turn to Jim here. And first of all, I think Jim and I both wish you the best with your health.
Certainly.
Your health,
yeah,
and your happiness.
Certainly.
And I want to ask Jim a question based on Chris's phone call. She talked about how, in her perception, people who make a lot of money tend to be more wasteful. Now, the word wasteful, I want to ask you if you think it's subjective or if it can be an objective question.
Well, yeah, it could be turned into an objective question. We could agree about what the definition of wasteful is and then look to see if that definition is met. Yeah, certainly.
Yeah, because some people would say if you belong to a country club and you are, you know, basically building walls to society and only letting your wealthy friends in and you're spending lots of money on mediocre dinners that you couldn't tell the difference on and you're playing on golf courses that are massive that could be public parkland, well, Malcolm Gladwell and others would say that you're wasteful. But some, they might defend themselves and say, that's unfair. How dare you say what is wasteful or not? So in some standards, you think we can be objective versus all subjective?
Sure. I mean, you know, we can measure whether Malcolm Gladwell's definition of wasteful applies to the wealthy. I mean, we could certainly do that. Certainly, people might disagree about that definition. The rich being wasteful, I don't know of research that I can look at that I can cite to you to back that up. My feeling is that's probably true, but I'm feeling a little bit adrift in terms of the research.
Sure, okay. And I'll sneak in one more question from a listener with the caveat that Jim Allen is not here to give you life advice on where you should live. But Benjamin writes and says, he says, I'm a 23-year-old American who grew up in a middle-class household. I'm just figuring out what I want to do with my life, but I feel unhappy with the psyche of our economic system. I felt even more depressed knowing the values of the Nordic states, as you mentioned on the show. Would I benefit from trying to leave the United States, or would I pay psychologically trying to fit in somewhere else?
Yeah. Yeah. You know, it's hard to comment on any individual person without having a lot more knowledge about that person. Can say that if you left and went to a new place, though, family relationships, intimate, emotionally connected relationships are so important, and I would be concerned that if you went to a new place, whether you could replace those relationships quickly. Having a culture that you're familiar with would be important as well. But the research does indicate that societies that structure themselves differently than the way the United States structures itself are happier. So, finding a community in the United States, a section of the United States where, you know, I don't know. Maybe we could change things in the United States.
Down to our last 30 seconds or so. So when you think about people in your own life, when you ask them, are you happy? It's important to know if their basic needs are met, as Jim's book points out. And if they're not, you can help them with that. Beyond that, though, it sounds to me like there's a lot of other ways that we can spread well-being. And sometimes it's the smaller little things. A final message for our listeners?
Yeah. The way we spend money, I didn't get to that before, can be important. Spending on others, getting experiences rather than buying materialistic kinds of goods. Keep in mind the socio-structural kinds of factors, but also keep in mind that practicing gratitude, optimism, important, and relationships are really important.
Well, gratitude comes up in the book, too. I mean, see, we probably need to do a whole other hour on what we missed.
That would be great.
Gratitude correlates really strongly there and sometimes doesn't show up for people who are sort of steeped in materialism. So keep thinking about it. I try to keep thinking about what I'm grateful for every day and expressing that.
That's good. We should all.
And Jim, I'm grateful for your book. I really am. The book is The Psychology of Happiness in the Modern World. Yes, it's a textbook. It reads very simply, and I think it's important. And I'm glad that you put it together. Thank you so much for coming in.
Well, thank you for the opportunity. I appreciate it.
Jim Allen, Associate Professor of Psychology at SUNY Geneseo. Short break. More connections next.